The Senate Public Safety and Budget Division will come to order. The first bill on the agenda is Senate File 1307. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I am extremely pleased today to be here on behalf of Senate File 1307, which is a request for funding for a number of very valuable programs that address sexual violence and domestic abuse. This is an area that is extremely important.
Excuse me, Senator Olson, does somebody have a telephone going? Can you take that call outside or turn the phones off? Thank you. Please, Senator Olson, sorry.
That's fine. Thank you. This is something that's very important to me personally on a professional level and also in terms of my district, as I'm sure it's important to districts around the state. In my professional capacity over the last 20 of years, I've represented a number of victims of sexual and domestic assault, and I know the tragedy that happens in people's lives, the feeling of hopelessness, and in some cases even the loss of life that occurs, and I've seen that firsthand in our district. Just this last summer, I took part in a ceremony that really brought home this issue in a very visual way. In our district, we have gravestones for each of the victims of sexual and domestic violence that are set up publicly, and this year it was next to our library downtown. And to walk around to those gravestones and see the number of needless deaths that have occurred in such a small community, they're actually, and I have a list here, just in the last 16 years, there are over 20 victims of domestic violence and sexual assault, people who were murdered in their homes because of family violence. And I know that this is something that's very important to all of us, that we do what we can to prevent this from continuing to occur in the future. And so for that reason, we're asking for a modest 4% increase per year for each of the next biennium, and basically trying to restore some of the funding and put money into programs that have been very dramatically cut in recent years. We also are asking for a one-time supplemental award of $8.3 million, which could be funded through the one-time money that's available at this point to try to support a one-time investment in awareness, prevention, and other activities that have been sidelined with the funding challenges we've had over the last 4 years, so to try to get those types of programs back on track. With me here today, I have the first speaker, Donna Dunn, who's with the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Also testifying will be Jennifer Notis and Cindy Cook.
Very good. Ms. Dunn, please restate your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Donna Dunn. I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. And I am very pleased to be able to speak today to you and members of the committee about our request for funding for Minnesota's crime victim programs and how that funding can, in fact, benefit programs across the state. I hope that people on this committee have been able to connect with the program in your community that provides services to sexual assault victim survivors so that you can learn about the multiplicity of strategies that they use to reach citizens in their communities. Well, I am here with my partners from the other coalitions, and while we share many similarities in the work that we do, we also have some really large distinctions in the kind of approaches and the work that we do in communities. I would like to just very briefly identify some of the distinctions about responding to incidents of sexual assault. We know that sexual assault is the least frequently reported violent crime that occurs in our society. For a lot of reasons, victims of sexual assault remain very quiet, very silent, and very private about their crime. These are crimes that, for the most part, happen in privacy. Victims of sexual assault, particularly those who are victimized by a person who is known to them, do not call 911. Typically, no one intervenes. Typically, victims are able to remove themselves from the situation and just vow to never have contact with that person again. There are taboos about talking about sexual assault or even sexuality in our communities. And generally, there is confusion about what sexual assault is. I remember staffing a crisis line and hearing over and over again from callers, I don't know why what happened to me bothers me so much. I can't sleep. I'm having nightmares. But I don't understand this. And frankly, what we hear from victims is, I didn't know that what happened to me was in fact a crime and that there was recourse. Consequently, victims of sexual assault, most victims of sexual assault do not reach out for help. They don't realize that there is help available or that it is something that actually applies to them. They keep their traumatic event quiet until they cannot keep it quiet any longer. And the costs of that are real. The costs can be devastating to the individual, to the community, to families. We know the other thing that we know about that is that when victims of sexual assault are silent, we do not know who sex offenders are in our community. Because these are such private crimes, we really learn about who sex offenders are when victims are able to come forward and risk talking to advocacy programs or systems in communities. This is really a particular challenge in 13 counties in Minnesota which have no sexual assault services targeted, in fact, to that crime. Victims in those 13 counties end up having to go to neighboring counties or to seek other services that may not be as effective in responding to their particular kind of crisis. I think that we should not be comfortable leaving those 13 counties unserved in Minnesota. Well, I want to say that sexual assault advocacy programs are the prime way that we can change this course of action. Our programs, on an average of $40,000 a year, serve counties in a number of ways. We are, according to the standards that are required for funding by the Office of Justice Programs, counties must provide 24-hour services. They must staff a crisis line, be able to respond to victims' needs 24 hours a day. They supply a full range of assistance to victims with accompaniment to court, accompaniment to law enforcement, transportation, assistance with finding housing, with finding services for children. They engage in systems change work, helping law enforcement, prosecutors, medical professionals, probation officers, and others use their statutorily granted tools most effectively in providing safety to victims and holding offenders accountable. These programs also do community education. They try to get to schools and to colleges. They do professional training with mental health professionals and others in communities. And they work to partner in communities in order to maximize the community resources for the best outcomes for survivors. I want you to know that programs, sexual assault advocacy programs, are the gateway for helping victims who are reluctant to reach out to other services in the community because of the taboos. These are the places where victims know that they can trust, that they will be believed, that they will not be shamed, and that they will not be held accountable, but that they will be ultimately helped. And finally, I would say that one area that we really know that we need to focus on is prevention. When services have been in communities for 20 years, advocates understand the need to start doing work on primary prevention. Sexual violence is preventable. We have recently, in the past year, trained all of our partner advocacy programs in a series of trainings on primary prevention. Our programs, unfortunately, have not had the resources to introduce the strategies into their community. They are ready to go. We are ready to go. We want to prevent sexual violence. We need help in doing that. The funding that would be available through this increase would help us down that road, would allow us to get some roots in place in communities to start addressing the social norms that cause sexual violence or that support it. Minnesota has been known as a leader in providing sexual assault advocacy. It was one of the first states to commit state funds to supporting advocacy centers, and we're proud of that history. We hope that commitment will continue. And I just finally want to say that every time a sexual assault happens and a victim has no recourse or no support or no information, we are all harmed. Our communities are harmed, and we need to change that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Nunn. Any questions for the witness? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Dunn, would you please explain to me of those 13 counties in the state of Minnesota, which it's hard to believe that there isn't something going on in those counties, but I do believe that. How are you going to go about getting that going? I mean, can you go through the process a little bit without being too labored?
Madam Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, we have a close working relationship with the Office of Justice Programs, and they are ultimately the granting agency for crime victim service money. Our role as a coalition is to provide technical assistance and training and support to new and developing programs. And it would be our goal to work with the Office of Justice Programs in understanding how we can provide both pre-application support to those counties and those communities, as well as helping them identify what neighboring communities they may be able to talk to get insight into how effective programming actually looks. You know, what the elements of effective programming are.
So follow up, please.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you. Just a follow up question. So there are interest in those counties now.
Ms. Dunn.
Madam Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, it is. There have been counties that have, in fact, in the past, attempted to request funding. I'm not entirely sure that all 13 counties have made that request of the Office of Justice Programs. That would be something to follow up with them. We do know that two of our 13 counties are metro ring counties that have, in fact, that would be Isanti County and Chisago County have no targeted sexual assault services. There has not been new money available for many years, and so there's not been an opportunity for programs to even seek funding from the state.
Thank you.
Yes.
Very good. Our next testifier is Ms. Jennifer Notice. Did I say your name right?
You did. Thank you. I am the executive director for the Minnesota General Crime Victim Coalition, and I want to thank you for allowing me to speak today on this issue. Over the last several months, the three coalitions have had the opportunity to review the current status of funding and to take the time to listen to the needs of our programs. As to the General Crime Coalition, we've been in contact with the 60-plus membership programs that we represent and listen to the difficulties they struggle with under the current budget climate. Let me speak briefly as to what general crime is to help provide a broader understanding as to why these funds are so vital to our communities and to our citizens. The General Crime Coalition has identified 39 areas of crime that are covered under the umbrella of general crime. The faces of general crime victims include robbery victims, harassment victims, identity theft victims, elder abuse victims, and the families and friends of homicide victims. These are just a few. Advocates working in the area of general crime must be uniquely qualified to address the needs of each and every victim in each of these 39 areas of crime. Not only must they be qualified to assist the needs of the victim, but they must also comply with the standards that Donna touched on that are outlined by the funding provider. As such, they must provide community outreach and education, work on systems change and professional training, and actively work to create partnerships with other agencies and system staff in their area. Currently, 60 counties within the state of Minnesota receive funding to offer services in the way of general crime, leaving 27 unfunded counties. Individuals within these counties often do not receive any services for the crime of which they suffer and often encounter further complications and victimization as a result of such. I urge members to truly consider the importance and effect this bill will have on their own constituents and the communities they represent. Due to limited funding and, in some cases, budget cuts, programs have had to limit their actions to addressing one main concern, the victim walking through their door. As the cost of business continues to rise, programs have had to set aside important projects which ensure system accountability, provide training for professionals, and education and prevention to our children. This is due to a lack of resources, time, and availability. The truth of the matter is, advocates are changing the way people think about crime, the way they respond to it, and the way they coordinate to prevent it. Without advocates and the programs they represent, communities, individuals, and children suffer. This bill represents our opportunity to recommit to these programs and provide them with the funding they need to impact public awareness, provide community outreach and education, and improve communities and systems response to victims of general crime, domestic assault, and sexual assault. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Norris. Are there any questions for the witness? Very good. Our last witness is Ms. Cindy Cook. And Ms. Cook, we want to have a robust discussion on the bill, so if you could, whatever they haven't said, just add that, fill that between the blanks, that would be very helpful.
All right, I will do my best. So my name is Cindy Cook, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee for the opportunity to speak in support of this bill today. You'll hear a common theme, I think, across all three coalitions, because we are passionate cheerleaders for the advocacy programs that we represent and the changes that they make in each and every community where they exist in this state. What I want to speak to today is the impact of domestic violence on Minnesota. I'm hoping that many of you have had a chance to take a look at the 2006 MCBW Femicide Report. It was distributed last week during our Violence Against Women Action Day. For those of you who may not have had a chance to read that, I want to let you know that last year in Minnesota, at least 20 women and 12 children were killed in acts of domestic violence. And Minnesota has long been committed to ending battering and to providing options to victims for their safety. But it's clear when we have 20 deaths of women and 12 deaths of children that we've got gaps in this system. We're working on many different efforts with a number of different partners this year to address policy gaps, and I think you'll be hearing about some of those efforts later in your hearing today. Today we want to speak to the funding for advocacy programs, however. Just as with sexual assault and general crime advocacy programs, battered women's advocates work with prosecutors, judges, law enforcement, probation officers, and others in the criminal justice system to ensure that the policies and protocols that are put in place maximize safety rather than compromise safety. But we still have gaps in that system. Advocates also work with other systems, like training for child protection, housing providers, the medical community. They work from finding diapers and formula to helping families find safe and affordable housing to monitoring systems to make sure that they are following through on the kinds of tools that we have, like protection orders and restraining orders. We deeply appreciate the support that this body has provided in the past. And the positive news about the funding is that we know that these kinds of investments do work. National studies have shown that since 1994, the rate of non-fatal intimate partner violence against women has decreased by 61%. During that time, the number of women killed, this is from national studies, by an intimate partner has decreased by 26%. At the same time, we've seen a 51% increase in the reporting of domestic violence. That's a testament, I think, to the efforts to increase public awareness about this crime. We're on the right path, but we know that we can and we must do better. The services that have made all of this possible are beginning to be eroded, and I'm sure that you've heard this on many fronts, but while the costs of heating, health insurance, rent, and other necessities have gone through the roof, the state's investment in victim services has not seen an increase in more than a decade. At the same time, successful public awareness efforts have increased the number of women seeking services. Leading programs to focus their efforts on meeting the immediate emergency needs. As a result, public education, prevention efforts, system monitoring types of efforts have begun to suffer. So I'll conclude by saying that we look forward to a day when every battered woman has a safe place to go, when every system is working closely in a coordinated fashion to make sure that those gaps are filled and are responding effectively to the needs of battered women and their children, and when every community has access to the education that is so essential to ultimately ending this violence. We look forward to the day when every child can grow up without violence. We hope that you'll be a partner with all of us in those efforts. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cook. Are there any questions for this witness? Members and maybe Ms. Dunn or Ms. Cook, it is my understanding that the request here is sort of making up for past cuts that have taken place. So it really is not a lot of additional money on top, but it's just bringing you up to where you would be if there had not been so many cuts. Is that accurate, Ms. Dunn?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, to an extent that is accurate. We are actually looking for a 4% increase of each year of the biennium to make up for a bit of the loss. It actually doesn't cover the entire loss, but it would make up for, it would help us with a bit of the loss. And then the supplemental grants, which would be out of one-time funding, that is clearly to help programs renew some of their awareness raising and prevention efforts that have had to be sidelined because of the tightness in funding. Many of our programs have experienced loss of staff, inability to pay staff, reimburse staff for mileage and some out-of-pocket expenses. So we actually find that staff members at programs are bearing some of the costs of the loss of funding. Yes.
Ms. Cook. Madam Chair, I would add to that many of the direct service providers in Minnesota that experienced cuts over the last 5 years, the Office of Justice Programs was able to replace some of that funding with federal dollars. But over the course of a decade, when the cost of inflation, even for those programs that saw some of their funding replaced with federal dollars, that base level of funding is not keeping pace with inflation. The programs that shelters in particular, battered women shelters in particular, did not see a reinstatement of the majority of funding that was cut. And I think the key piece that all of us have brought to the table here today that Donna spoke to was the prevention piece. We want to make sure that we're working to stop all of these crimes before they start. And we're hoping that this one-time infusion of funding for prevention efforts will really help jumpstart us in that direction. Thank you.
Any questions for the witnesses or Senator Olson? Seeing none. Senator Ingebrigtsen, could you move Senate File 1307?
Yes, I would. Could I make one comment first, please?
Yes.
Yes. Senator Ingebrigtsen. Those that know me, probably a few of them in this room that do know me, I hail from the community of law enforcement, and over the years I've seen this group of very, I might add, dedicated servants to what a horrible, horrible problem that goes on, work over the years and working with them and coming an awful long ways that we have come, I think, in it not being just a one time it was pegged as just being anti-male, anti-man thing too. I come from that era, quite frankly, in law enforcement, and coming into this era now where we're starting to see the dollars that have been invested doing some good, quite frankly, and they do a remarkable job. And I sat on the board of Listening Ear for many, many years in central Minnesota where some of the stories that could not even be told at that table would have just absolutely put everybody in this room in tears with what they deal with. And, of course, I myself and my officers dealing with the same thing. So I just I can't say enough about the groups that are here today and what they do for our families and that need help, and especially our kids. And I'd like to see that end. So with that, I would move that Senate file
1307.
I believe it is to be laid on the table for inclusion.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Senator Ingebrigtsen moves that Senate File 1307 be recommended to pass and be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Any further discussions? Anybody in the audience who wants to testify against this bill? See none. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. The motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Next on the agenda is Senate File 1613, Senator Bonoff. To our audience participants, as well as to any senators at this table who are or out in the audience who are going to be presenting bills, we have a very packed agenda, and so we're asking you to be considerate of our time. I think based on the general discussion, based on Senator Ingebrigtsen's comments to the previous testifiers, I think you've got a friendly audience to these issues, and that's why you're in this committee. And so help us move along so that we can get all the bills done in time. I would greatly appreciate that. Senator Bonoff, I didn't ask for the testimonies to be short just because we're short. So.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Bonoff.
Okay. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm very pleased to be able to present this bill here today, and this bill is asking for us to take some action on a very serious subject, and a subject that means a lot to myself and the testifiers I have with me today. And this subject is actually personal because I am here with Vicki Swenson. And Vicki, besides living in my community, she's a teacher in my children's high school, as is her husband. And our community suffered a tragic loss this past summer when Vicki's sister was murdered. And Vicki will speak about that. But this bill, I'm carrying this bill because of my commitment to do something about that. And the legislation we're bringing forward is in three parts. The part that is before this committee simply asks for an appropriation to provide a pre-service and additional in-service training for peace officers with regard to domestic violence. And with that, I will... I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I move the A2 amendment, which simply cleans up the bill that you have before you.
Yes. Senator Latz moved the A2 amendment.
Is it in there?
Huh? It's right there.
Right. Has the distributed?
No. Do you need a copy, Senator Engelbretson? Since the A2 amendment is the amendment to put the bill in the shape that the author desires it to be in, Senator Latz moved the A2 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes. Now, Senator Bonoff.
Thank you. So I'd like to introduce Vicki Seliger Swenson.
Ms. Swenson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Vicki Seliger Swenson, and I'm here today to talk about my sister, Terry Lee. Terry was the 15th woman murdered in Minnesota in 2006 by an intimate partner. Also killed that fatal morning was a man whom she planned to marry, Tim Hawkinson Sr. But to many, my sister was more than number 15. My sister was a loving daughter, mother, sister, and friend. In fact, she was my best friend. She was the maid of honor in my wedding, and I was the maid of honor in hers. She married a man named Ty Lee, who together they had four amazing children when he died in a car accident in 2001. Together, with the help of her family and friends, she rallied around her four small children, ages 1, 3, 5, and 7, and did an amazing job. 2 years later, she began dating a man she met while working at 3M. He was a trusted colleague. He had been a 25-year employee with no criminal history. They shared some mutual friends, and he seemed safe. They dated on and off for nearly 2 years before she ended the relationship for good last spring. But he was relentless for them to be together, to the point where on July 29th, 2006, he broke into her home and attacked her with butcher knives. She escaped when her neighbor saw his car and knew to call 911. From that moment, I am so proud of my sister because she followed the system to a T. She gave statements to the police. She pressed charges. She went to court. She testified. She begged the judge, and I'll use her documented words, "I have no doubt in my mind he will return to my home to kill me." 2 days later, he was let out on bail after paying the 10% required bond of $7,500. One of the conditions of his release was that he was to have no contact with Terry, her parents, or her children. Yet he violated that no contact order on multiple occasions. There was an email sent from his father's computer asking for the two of them to meet. She did not reply. She called police. Maplewood police came, and they responded to her with that was his way of trying to get back together. She responded to the police officer, "No, he wants me dead." She was also told, because he lives in River Falls, Wisconsin, that they could not cross the state line to arrest him, which we know is not accurate. On September 20th, he also showed up at her daughter's volleyball match at an away junior high. The police were called. My sister was called. My niece identified him. They have him on school surveillance camera, and witnesses gave statements. But again, there was no arrest. Less than 48 hours later, On September 22, 2006, our biggest fear became a reality when her ex-boyfriend broke into her home and killed Terry and Tim, while Terry's two young daughters fled to the neighbor's house for help, and her two young boys hid in their closet for nearly 2 hours until they were rescued by members of the SWAT team. Her ex-boyfriend recovered from a self-inflicted gunshot wound in a gunshot wound from a member of the SWAT team. He is now awaiting trial for two counts of murder in the first degree. My sister left behind four beautiful children that my husband and I are now raising with our three daughters. Thank you. As I retell my sister's story, it is obvious that there are some issues with enforcement. I believe that we have good laws in Minnesota, but if they are not enforced, I am not sure who they are protecting. There is a lot of local and national momentum and interest in Terry's story, and I have asked the question why repeatedly, and the common response is, your sister did everything right, and she is dead. And I believe we have an opportunity as Minnesotans to respond to this tragedy and to provide the skills, the knowledge, and the training for peace officers to better enforce our laws, which will save lives and will cost a lot less than prosecuting murders. Thank you.
Well, thank you for that story, and I know it hurts to have to retell the story, but we appreciate it because it really provides and stark illustration to the need that we need that we have in the community and what we need to do. So, thank you. Any questions for the witness? Senator Bonhoff, do you have another witness?
I do. I have Carla here, who's really just here to answer technical questions on the bill. Carla, if you would introduce yourself.
My name is, for the record, Madam Chair, my name is Carla Frucci, and I'm with the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. I'm the Director of Public Policy and Systems Change there, but I'm here just to stand for any questions.
And, Madam Chair, at the rally at the Capitol last week, Dateline was here filming Vicki for the day, and they are following the story and will be following it through this process as we go through our various bills, because they have seen this as an occasion to bring this to the attention of officers all over the country so that we can impact the situation. And then lastly, with regard to the Hopkins School District, where Vicki taught and her husband taught, this really has rallied the community, and they have raised several hundred thousand dollars to help this family in the many things that they now have taken on.
Very good. Thank you very much. Any further questions for Senator Bonhoff? Senator Engelbrechtson.
Madam Chair, thank you. I don't see a dollar figure here. Did I miss something?
Senator Engelbrechtson, I can't speak for Senator Higgins, but I too have some bills with blanks, and I think what that says is
take it up. At
it depends.
We'll take it up.
Depends on what you have, Madam Chair.
I think
Chair.
Senator Bonhoff is in the same position as I would be in a couple of minutes when I'm in her seat, which is, we beg, and we'll see what we get.
Right, exactly. Thank you.
But, you should know that I had a bill that was in this committee a couple of weeks ago, and it was to create a pilot project to coordinate between the different systems in our community so that there aren't any cracks for people to fall through, and to create more comfort and more a sense of reliability that when we go get that order for protection, or that it will work because there is a convergence of multiple levels of law enforcement and social services and people who are working on that. So at some point this session, we'll try to get something done. Thank you very much. Senator Latz, move that Senate file 1613 as amended be recommended to pass and be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let the record reflect that we've been voting the last couple of bills, and we do have quorum for both of those bills. Senator Latz, I had indicated for you to go, but I think I see Senator Rest in the audience. So, Senator Rest, welcome to the committee. You have Senate File 1445.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate the
the courtesy. We're having an extremely important hearing in room 15 about problem gambling, and I can tell you the we were just listening to the testimony from a person who has been plagued with that all of his life, and it was occurred to me that there's more than one way to destroy one's life and the life of those around you that that you love. On the other hand, there are ways of saving lives and preparing our young people for a good future, and that is what the Mosaic program in my communities has been doing over the last several years. And we come before you today to describe that program in Senate File 1445 and to ask for consideration of an appropriation to support their efforts truly at crime prevention. With me today to testify are Elise Farnsworth, who is the Executive Director of the Mosaic Youth Program, Mr. Brad Brown, who is Chair of the Board of the Friends of the Mosaic and a member of the Robbinsdale 281 School District. And since this is a partnership organization, we have the Honorable Renee Bowman, who is the Mayor of Crystal, also with us to testify. And then we have Lysandra Higgins, who is a student at Cooper High School, and perhaps the most important of the people who are going to be speaking today on behalf of this bill. So first, Madam Chair, I'd like to introduce Ms. Farnsworth.
Ms. Farnsworth, welcome to the committee. Please restate your name for the record.
Thank you. Elise Farnsworth, Executive Director of the Friends of the Mosaic. Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for hearing my testimony today. I'd like to just give you a little bit of background about the Mosaic Youth Center, which serves middle and high school students in the northwest suburbs of Hennepin County and is located in Brooklyn Park. We are a nonprofit organization that strives to help all youth build upon their own educational, social, recreational, creative, and leadership abilities for the benefit of the Northwest suburbs and the state of Minnesota now and in the future. But we realize that this is a really big goal, and so we have very strong community partnerships and collaborations that make our work possible. And those include partnerships with local nonprofits and other youth-serving organizations, with our key partners in the Mosaic Youth Center Project, the Robbinsdale Area Redesign Family Service Collaborative, Fairview Recovery Services, the Annex Teen Clinic and Family and Children's Services, the local area school districts of Robbinsdale Area Schools, Osseo Schools, and Brooklyn Center Schools, many parents, community members, and, of course, the youth, and also the cities and the local law enforcement. And one of the programs that I'd like to use to highlight that is our middle school program, which is actually called Kids and Cops. And I believe it's a wonderful model of how after-school programs and youth programs can be used for crime prevention. Kids and Cops is a program for middle school students where police officers come and give their police officer time to serve as mentors to the young students. Through the program, they work on academics. They have time for mentoring with the police officers to build healthy relationships. And they also have social recreational opportunities that they can participate in. So basketball, volleyball, hip-hop dance, things like that. And the police officers actually do those things along with them. So they're building healthy relationships. We also offer a variety of programs for high school students. I'm going to let Lysandra tell you a little bit more about those, but I think they also provide an opportunity for the young people to choose really positive things over the juvenile crime and things like that. Since September, we've served over 400 youth and their families, and all of our programs that the youth have been served in are aimed at reducing the juvenile crime, increasing youth civic engagement, reducing the achievement gap, and improving academic and life skills
for all youth. The legislation before you could benefit the Mosaic Youth Center and the youth and families in the northwest suburbs of Hennepin County and Minnesota by allowing the youth to have that choice to make the healthy behaviors over those being involved in the risky and crime behaviors. And there's a report out by an organization called Fight Crime, Invest in Kids. And I think they put it best when they say that the after-school time really is a time that either can be prime time for juvenile crime or a time for positive, healthy youth development. And we hope that you will give the youth a choice to choose the positive, healthy youth development.
Very good. Should we have Ms. Lysandra Higgins speak? Ms. Higgins?
Yep. Lysandra is going to just tell you a little bit about her experiences at Mosaic, and I'll let her go.
Ms. Higgins, if Senator Higgins was here, she would be very happy that you're at the testifier table. And if you were Hmong American, you guys would be cousins. Did that make your nervousness go away?
No,
please
not
go
really.
Ahead.
No, not really.
Not really. Go ahead.
Well, my experience at the Mosaic Center is it helped me with my academic support and my social status with others. And it made me work with adults more and, you know, be part of a community that I thought that was good enough. The Mosaic Center has helped me because I have good grades now, and I used to have, you know, not so good grades, but now I have, you know, better grades. And I'm part of the Mosaic Advisory Council that helps me work with the adults also. And I think that's very important where adults and children work together. And I think that the Mosaic helps other people by it keeps students and other people off the streets, and it gives them an opportunity to work on things that they thought they couldn't work on, and it gives them an opportunity to show.
It's okay.
It gives them an opportunity to show off things that they thought they couldn't do, like they couldn't, you know, succeed successfully in school, couldn't, you know, perform well, and so.
Like hip-hop dancing,
yeah,
and all the other cool stuff.
And
you do not want to see a group of senators try to hip-hop dance.
I beg your pardon.
No. Well, very good. Thank you. Do you have anything else to add?
No.
Good. Well, say thank you for coming. It takes a lot of courage to come to the Capitol and testify on a bill. And so I really appreciate your being here.
Thank you.
Yeah. Madam Mayor.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I also want to point out that we have several members of the Mosaic Youth Center sitting against the wall. And if maybe you want to raise your hands to show who you are. This is many of the children or young people from my community. I appreciate
Madam Mayor, could you restate your name for the record?
Yes,
ma'am. I apologize.
Renee Bowman. Just want to make a couple of points. A couple of weeks ago, I was at a local Northwest meeting that had mayors, council people, chiefs of police talking about the increased crime in the northwestern suburban area. And one of the things that the police officers recognized was the importance of the Mosaic Youth Program and what a model it had become, and how can we look at perhaps replicating that in other areas within the northwest suburbs. So it's recognized by local law enforcement as being a wonderful prevention tool. Part of the other thing I think that is so very important for our youth is the youth center gives them access. It gives them access to learning, which supports our local schools. It gives them access to services, allowing them to deal with mental and physical health issues. It gives them access to building relationships, just as they were talking about the cops and kids. It gives them access to building relationships from youth to youth, and more importantly, perhaps, as youth to adult. And it also gives them access to recreation in a safe place that's drug and alcohol free. And I believe that by having access, it helps our young people create hope for their own future. My city has been very strong advocate of working with youth for several years. And I'm actually happy to report that the crime in the city of Crystal has come down each year for the past 3 years. And although I can't prove a correlation between the work that my police department does with the youth in the community and our strong association with the Mosaic Youth Center, we're one of the very few northwestern suburban communities not experiencing some of the problems that the other communities are experiencing. And just one other point is the National League of Cities, which is our city is a proud member of, very much over the past year and ongoing is focusing on the need in our cities for building youth centers and providing services to youth on an after-school basis. So another support group for the cause. Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor Bowman. Thanks for taking the time to come.
You're welcome.
And our final speaker, Mr. Brown.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Brad Brown. I'm the chair of the board of Friends of Mosaic and also a member of the Robbinsdale School Board. I want to talk to you about why does the Mosaic need to exist? And I think, simply put, it needs to exist because teenagers hang. And if you've ever raised a teenager or you've been a teenager, which is probably 100% of us, I guess, you know that there's a very, very strong drive to have social interaction with your peers, to get together with other teens and do stuff. And they're going to hang in malls and in homes, but in all cases they're going to hang. They're going to get together. Mosaic provides a place for our teens to hang in a place that's safe, that's sober, and provides some constructive activities for them to participate in. If we don't have places like Mosaic, we know that teens are still going to hang, and sometimes they hang in places that get them into trouble, and they hang in ways that lead to undesirable behavior. So that Mosaic provides a place for teens to come together, learn, have some fun, and even contribute to the community, as the mayor pointed out. The second thing I want to point out, and by the way, I've been involved with Mosaic since 1997, and I've gotten to know the staff there and a lot of the students that have come through the program very well. And one of the things that has always been most exciting to me is the leadership development that happens with the teens. The programming that goes on in the Mosaic is designed by the teens. And I don't profess to be a leadership development expert, but my personal experience has been people who are leaders have learned to lead by leading, by being in places and situations where they have to make decisions and then be held accountable for the decisions that they make. You know, that's sort of the essence of leadership. Teens in the Mosaic Youth Center do that. They design the programming. They help raise the funds. They are accountable for their behavior in the facility. And all that is leadership development. They project themselves out into the community. They do community service work. They develop a sense of we're not just passive bystanders in this community, we're members of this community. The money that we are hoping to receive through this grant will allow us to expand our programming and to encourage more teens to hang at the Mosaic Youth Center. So I thank you for your support, and we welcome any questions.
Thank you. Ms. Farnsworth, what's the budget for the Mosaic organization as a whole?
At this point, our budget as a whole is roughly, with all of the operating expenses and salaries and programs and everything, it's about $400,000 to $450,000 a year, depending on how many programs you put out. If we were going to continue our existing program, continue to serve the same number of students, it would stay at that level. We are hoping, like Brad said, to be able to serve more students to make sure that more students are off the streets and doing productive activities, so to increase our budget in the next 2 years.
So, Ms. Farnsworth, your plan is to keep the $450,000 current operations in place with other sources, but with the additional $300,000 request, that would build or increase the program?
We actually are looking at about a 65% budget reduction in our current funding in the next year, and so that's also part of coming to the state at this pivotal time for our organization. And that is primarily due to funding that we've received in the past from the Family Service Collaborative in our area, which they are undergoing budget cuts, and then therefore our funding that comes from them is being cut. We're also aggressively looking at other funding streams from foundations, individual donors, and things like that.
So, Ms. Farnsworth, what would happen if we couldn't get you this this funding from the state to the project?
Well, we would be sad, first of all, but we would continue to pursue the other funding avenues, but we may have to look at either cuts in programs not being able to serve as many students.
And I would have to buy more frozen cookie dough.
Yes, we do a lot of youth fundraisers. Yes, that's right. We'd expect Senator Rust to then to make it up in cookie dough.
Senator Rosen just said that. She doesn't even bake them.
You eat it raw?
Any questions? Any questions for the witnesses or for Senator Rust? Any further questions? Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move Senate File 1445 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
On Senator Rosen's motion, any discussion? Senator Neville.
I'm sorry I got here late, sorry, but I'm just looking at the language. Mm-hmm. As long as we're going to include this, could I suggest some change in language? Mm-hmm. It says on line 111, the majority of the organization's services. How much of the majority? Are you talking about 90% is going to be provided to economically disadvantaged youth, or 51%? Can we put a number in there?
Ms. Farnsworth.
I'm sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair. The current number of students who we serve who qualify for free and reduced lunch is at 82%.
I would like to suggest that we say at least 80% then, instead of the majority.
Senator Rust, your thoughts on that?
Is that okay?
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, I'm surprised it's not even higher, but 80% is fine.
Okay. I'd so move.
Senator Neville moves that on line 1.11 after the period, delete the majority and insert at least 80%. Any discussions on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay.
Chair?
Yes, Senator Neville.
One more just language clarification. On line 112, the expected outcomes are expectations. I don't know if that's the right language to use. What I would suggest is we should say the organization must work to reduce truancy, et cetera. I want you to be committed to it, not just expect it. Is that?
We think that is a very good suggestion and hope the committee will adopt that.
On line 1.12, after the delete expected outcomes, on line 1.13, delete of the, and after, on line 1.13, after organization, insert, must work, and then delete R. On that motion, any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Motion is adopted. Anything else, Senator Neville?
Just trying to improve the bill for Senator Rest.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. We really appreciate the time that you're taking this afternoon to hear this bill and to consider the young people of the Northwest suburbs.
Senator Rosen renews her motion that Senate File 1445, as amended, be recommended to pass and be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Motion passes.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Higgins.
Oh,
no problem. The next item on the agenda is Senate File 727.
Did you get my present?
Thank you, Matt.
Senator Chaudhry.
Everybody's trying to guess what it is.
Senator Commissioner Chaudhry.
This bill makes it felony to commit a theft of a computer with identity information of an individual. Am I getting deja vu? Did we hear this bill in your committee already?
Well, Senator Chaudhry, I am Senator Higgins today. And if you look closely, Senator Neville doesn't sit over there. He's sitting over here. Okay. And Senators Engelbrechtson and Rosen are here.
Reminds me of the movie Brazil.
We did hear it in judiciary, I believe.
And yes, okay. Senator Engelbrechtson did hear it. Perhaps the only person who hasn't heard this bill may be Senator Rosen.
All right.
But she's on board. So.
I'll make sure my arrest warrant is stamped before we move on. That's a
Senate file 727, Senator Chaudhry.
This bill makes it a felony to commit a theft of a computer that has identity information on it. Currently, it's not a felony. With the rising tide of identity theft, computers are lowering their reducing in value very quickly, and our current laws don't keep up with that value. So you steal a computer with a lot of personal information on it, you can really only charge them with a theft for that computer in the amount of a misdemeanor. And so we're changing that because of to make the theft of someone's personal information that is contained on a computer and used for thousands upon thousands of dollars of personal injury to people felony level.
Would you like Mr. Drizel to
yes, please.
Speak on the bill? Welcome to committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Al Drizel. I'm an assistant attorney general with the Minnesota Attorney General's Office, and at the risk of having you, some of you hear exactly what I said just yesterday, to some of you I do have some brief remarks. Identity theft is a growing problem in our information age. The growth of and the extent and severity of identity theft has been paralleled by an increase in the use of computers to store personal information. All too often, we hear stories about data breaches that occur when a laptop computer containing personal information is stolen. A single computer can be a gold mine for identity thieves. Under current law, the severity of the crime of computer theft is measured by the value of the computer. And because computers depreciate quickly, they typically have low resale value. This means that the theft of a computer with a market value of less than $500 may only be a misdemeanor, even though the computer contains valuable personal information. There is, at the present time anyway, no good way to put a monetary value on that information, although I'm sure we can all appreciate how valuable it is, the true value that it would have to an identity thief. The proposal makes the theft of a computer containing personal information a felony, regardless of the resale value of the computer. Attorney General Lori Swanson urges passage of this legislation, and I would be happy to answer any questions if I can.
Members and Senator Chaudhry, the bill, there's a fiscal note before you, and I think the bill, the reason why it's in this committee instead of going straight to the floor is because there's some bed impact implications. So if you look at page 7 of the fiscal note, there is no impact in 2007, but in 2008 and 2009 and subsequent out to 2011, it's expected that there might be some bed impacts, 6, 13, 13, and 13. Minor, but still some impact. Any questions for Senator Chaudhry or the witness? Seeing none. Senator Rosen,
yes.
Will you move the bill?
Yes.
Senator Rosen moves that Senate File 727 be recommended to pass and be laid over on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Motion passes. Senator Chaudhry, Senate File 1117.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill is brought to me by the Washington County Attorney's Office, dealing with burglary in the second degree. What we are doing in this bill is to make the penalty for committing a burglary in a church or a school or a government building commensurate with other crimes of burglary that that are committed in other types of dwellings or businesses or pharmacy. The Washington County attorney had experience where there was a break-in in a school building, and there was thousands of dollars of damage, and they couldn't charge that person with second-degree burglary. Experience on my end of this issue, we had about a year ago the break-in at the Hindu temple construction site in Maple Grove, about a year ago. Under that, and there were tens of thousands of dollars of damage to really priceless artifacts that were hand-carved and shipped from India. And under that, under that scenario, a religious establishment did not fall under the statute, and second-degree burglary could not be charged. So this would remedy a number of situations, and of course, any other religious establishment or school building would be covered by this change. And the fiscal note is even less than the previous bill. $25,000 in 07 and 08. I think we're 08, 09, so it would be $115,000 in 08 and 09 total.
Right. The members have in front of them the fiscal note, and the actual numbers are 25 in 08, 90 in 09, and then it climbs to 148 in 10 and 193 in 11. The actual bed impact is, I guess, 2 in 2008, 6 in 2009, 8 in 2010, and then 10 in 2011, estimated because of the increased level. So, any questions for Senator Shaw?
Are you basically putting these kind of de minimis bed impacts in the omnibus bill? Are you sending any of these to the floor? What's the threshold for sending just something to the floor?
Senator Chaudhry, it's my understanding that Senator Higgins wants to keep these here because she doesn't know where the target is. And because even though it's a pretty minimal amount, we need to be able to fund them. So,
good.
And I'm speaking for Senator Higgins. But
that's fine.
All right.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Chaudhry, how do these compare to other states surrounding us as far as?
Senator Chaudhry.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, I'm not sure. I've honestly not researched that. I can certainly find that out.
That would be interesting.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Senator Rosen. Senator Rosen moves that Senate File 1117 be recommended to pass and be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Any further discussions? Senator Neville.
Mr. Chair, I don't know, Senator Chaudhry, if you can answer this, but the last bill you just had raises damage to a computer to a 5-year felony. I'm trying to remember. What is this? Is this a 5-year felony?
Yes.
Okay. So these two bills, if you're going to break into a school or a public building, the chances are you're going to take a computer or do a lot more than $1,000 of damage there's probably some overlap of your last bill with this one.
Senator Neville, it's my understanding that this bill raises to a 10-year felony.
Oh, is it, this goes to 10-year then?
Yes.
Okay. Well, then there's not... Oh, yeah. There's probably a one level of difference then in terms of the sentencing guideline. All right.
It's possible there's some overlap.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right. Senator Rosen removes her motion. Any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay. Motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Madam Chair.
Yeah. What are we thinking?
Yeah, what he said.
See, which one do you want to take down?
Yeah, let's see.
Only have two left.
Yeah. Senator Neville, this is your chance.
This is our chance.
You're getting the gavel.
Oh, no.
And they're my bills.
Uh-oh.
Madam Chair, it says...
Okay, we're going to be tough on the next one.
go for the real bill.
Yes, no. Senator Neville.
Oh, man, there's a lot of them.
Two of them are for discussion only.
Which, Senator Marr, which one are we going to do? It's 279 first?
Yes.
Okay, that's discussion only.
No.
Senate file 279, Senator Marr.
Let's see here. Mr. Chair, I was hoping that I wouldn't be changed so then I could organize myself, but... Mr. Chair, members, Senate File 279 is here in this committee for discussion purposes only, and the reason is because for those of you who are in the Policy Committee, when we had this discussion, Senator Higgins very much is in agreement that she would like to see something happen with respect to some kind of a study to look at sealing of arrest records as well as collateral sanctions. And so in the Policy Committee, instead of going forward with the language addressing in substance those two areas, the Policy Committee felt that we needed to have more information and we needed to create the working groups to with very specific policy parameters to go off and come back with some concrete recommendations to the Judiciary Policy Committee. So in that committee, we created a collateral sanctions task force as well as a implementation working group to look at the policy parameters that was contained in the original Senate file 279 as introduced. That bill, because of the creation of the two working groups, are now in Senate Arrest Committee, where we will be, where they have jurisdiction over, I guess, working group types, the creation of working groups. But because Senator Higgins is interested in looking at this, I'm bringing this to the committee for your information. We don't know how much money will be available. But if there is any money available, we would like this committee and Senator Higgins to help fund the two task forces. Again, it is because we felt in the Policy Committee that the time was not ripe and we needed more help to help define the some concrete policy recommendations in those two areas. So instead of moving on the substance of the bill, we created these two task forces.
Is there any... Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, is there not a bill moved forward through? We're talking about expunging records. Is that what we're talking about here, or am I out of? Is there not one moved forward already through the
Senator Ma?
Senator Ingebrigtsen, Senator Ortman has a bill on expungements of records with some very concrete restrictions to the courts prescribing the procedure and how to do that. And that bill has passed out of the Policy Committee and has moved on to another committee. And then will most probably come to the Judiciary Budget Committee. This Senate File 279, as introduced, really looked more at not so much expungement of conviction records, but it looked at the sealing of arrest and charging records. And so they're a little bit different in that. And the committee did a lot of work in looking at the expungement issue in Senator Ortman's bill. That was an area that the committee determined it could, and along with that, Senator Betzel had a bill
on the same topic, and we had two committee sessions dedicated to looking at that. But in this area, because the CRIMNET work group had been working on some of these issues, in particular on collateral consequences, we wanted to help the working groups that were working already have been doing the work to continue to do their work in the hope that they might be able to come back to us with some concrete policy recommendations.
Other questions from the committee? Senator Maud, did you just want discussion among the committee?
Yes. Or,
okay, you're not asking for any further discussion from the public.
No, unless someone here really wants to testify on the bills. But this is just to give the committee notice that Senator Higgins, if the funding is there, she, you know, would like to the committee to know that she would be funding this if the funds are there.
Mr. Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Just a follow-up. I just need to make a comment. I'm just a little concerned for what it's worth, I guess. Who would like to be part of this somehow of expungement and talking about sealing records or opening records or going out and finding a judge to open records for whatever reason to seal those records. And I know there's some discussion about folks coming out of prison and they can't find jobs, they can't find places to live, things like that. And we just need to really be cautious about that, I guess, because most of the time when they come out of the system, they probably have been there several times already. So that's my only caution. Thanks.
Okay, Senator Letts.
Mr. Chair, Senator Mua, I applaud you for bringing this effort forward. There are a lot of collateral consequences to criminal convictions, most of which are never told to the defendant before they agree to plead guilty to something, because the prosecutor has no obligation to disclose that or share that. The judges, frankly, often don't and usually don't know all of the collateral consequences. Even the public defenders often either don't have the information or under no duty to disclose it and don't have jurisdiction or the funding to represent defendants regarding collateral consequences. And even if the individuals have representation, and many of them don't, when they decide to plead guilty. And these are civil these are not just a matter of what shows up on a background check when someone applies for a job down the road, or what might be in a licensing statute or rules that will prohibit them from getting licensed. I mean, I know of a situation in which a person had a misdemeanor domestic assault conviction, when they were younger, like 18 or 19, ended up going on to get a school's degree in surgical assistance or something like that, completed the degree, and when applying for the license found out that there was a prohibition on issuing a license if they had this particular kind of a conviction back in their record. And the school said, if you can't get a license, we can't give you the degree or something like that. And they ended up not being able to go into their chosen field until after they'd gotten an expungement. There are lots of driver's license consequences, motor vehicle forfeitures can result, and a lot of immigration consequences as well. People who are here legally, but who are applying for a change in their status or longer-term status, whatever it might be, can get hung up on collateral consequences. The courts have ruled repeatedly that those are not grounds for unwinding a conviction or allowing someone to withdraw a plea if they find out later on that there was a collateral civil consequence that they were unaware of. So they don't even have that option. So it's really important, I think, to get all this information out. In the end, I hope there might be some requirements for disclosures to people as they're considering how to resolve and whether to resolve a case they're facing so they know exactly what it is that they're getting themselves into.
Mr. Chair, and members, it is because we want to be more intentional and we want to be responsive and responsible about how we're going to craft legislation in these two areas, that instead of trying to, in a very quick fashion, you know, try to pull together language, I made the intentional decision that we needed to give ourselves and the working group who are have already been doing this work some time to really look at it. And the participants in these groups are crafted in such a way that we get, you know, law enforcement, a number of different stakeholders at the table so that we can have an informed discussion and an opportunity for some informed recommendations to come back to us. Just in light of the bills we've been hearing in this committee asking for money to do reentry programs, that alone is enough of a policy direction to say that if we're going to be focusing resources on looking at reentry, looking at, you know, bringing people who have been incarcerated or who have somehow had some involvement in the correctional system or in the criminal justice system, we're looking at how to incorporate them into the community as productive members. To do that, we're going to have to address some of the collateral sanctions issue because we ourselves have passed a number of laws and statutory prohibitions barring certain people from getting to certain jobs. And we're going to have to look at that and not that we're going to, you know, do away with that, because I think those laws were enacted for a reason. But this is why we want to do these task forces, because we want some smart, informed people to be looking at the big picture and then to come back with some recommendations on for us.
Senator Mott, where is this bill actually located now?
It's in Senator Rest's committee. And it will then be coming back to this committee.
Before next week, then, probably.
Before next week.
Okay. Well, I guess we don't need a motion, then. We'll just slide this over. All right. Any further discussion? All right. Let's move to the next one, which is Senate File 1005. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. And, again, that's for information information only. Because of the snowstorm, this bill was supposed to have been heard in the policy committee in order to get it to you here today. The snowstorm sort of displaced us, so we're asking for an information-only hearing. The bill will be forwarded to you as soon as the policy committee has had a chance to look at this tonight. But in essence, Mr. Chair and members, this bill emerged out of a situation where a family woke up one morning and found their vehicle to have been stolen. And when they contacted the police department to try to recover that vehicle, they were informed that it had been impounded and that they were told that in order to get their vehicle back, they would have to pay $300 to get their vehicle back. Even though it was stolen and it was just recovered by the police, it was impounded because I think by law the police have to keep custody or good custody of the things that they recovered. So it came to my attention. Pursuant to Minnesota law, a towing authority may tow a vehicle that a law enforcement official believes is stolen, and law enforcement must make a reasonable and good faith effort to notify the victim of the reported vehicle theft within 48 hours of recovering the vehicle. However, this notification period does not prevent law enforcement from impounding the vehicle immediately. And so oftentimes the owner of the vehicle may reclaim the vehicle, but only upon payment of all the towing and storage charge. And as a result of that, we have introduced this bill and the bill in front of you will have an amendment on it where instead of taking the money from the auto theft account, the amendment would just create a separate account where the appropriation will then be deposited into that account. So it won't be the victims won't be applying for reparation in the auto theft victims account. We'll be creating a separate appropriation from the general fund where the victims can then appropriately apply for reparation. It was my understanding that the way that the original bill was drafted, victims who have their vehicle stolen might not fit squarely under the definition of, you know, victims who are seeking reparation. And so to cure kind of that technical issue, we decided to just go with a separate appropriation.
Questions from the committee? This is just for discussion, too.
Just for discussion and your information that the bill will be coming to you.
Was the distinction, Senator Mott, that Crime Victims Reparation Board mostly deals with violent crimes, crimes against the person? So this one would be creating property restitution, more or less.
That's right, Senator Neville. And when I had a chance to look at that, I felt that that just didn't fit squarely and it wasn't appropriate. So,
Senator Ma, I think I agree with that, but just in terms of the administration of this fund, if you want to create one, why couldn't we create just a separate vehicle theft account fund with the Victims Crime Victims Reparation Board? Because the way that it's crafted, you're going to give it to the Commissioner of Public Safety, and they will make grants to prosecutors. It doesn't say they're going to make payments directly to victims. So, I mean, what are we going to ask for here? That each victim will have to get a separate grant for each victim? Wouldn't it be better just to give the money to the Crime Victims Board in a special account and let them deal with a victim, which they're used to doing, rather than creating a new system for doing that?
Senator Neville, I'm certainly open to any suggestions that would create efficiencies. I was working with Mr. Backus to try to just come up with a solution that's appropriate. I'll definitely take that into consideration since the amendment is not yet on the bill.
Okay. I mean, if I'm reading it right, it just seems that we're creating some inefficiencies by having to make grants to prosecutors and crime and victim assistance programs. I mean, I can envision a county attorney's office, maybe the bigger ones, would ask for $50,000, not knowing for sure how many claims they're even going to get. Maybe there'll be a rash of car thefts in one area of the state some year and not in others.
Right.
So it'd be better to keep it in the Crime Victims Reparation Board, seems to me.
Senator Neville, I will incorporate those comments, and in about at about 7:30 or 8 o'clock tonight.
Okay. See you then. Any other discussion? All right. Senator Ma, what's your next bill?
I believe it is Senate File 823.
Oh, never mind. We'll give it back to Senator Higgins here.
I think Senator Pappas is in the House, and since she's not a member of the committee, let's let her do her bills and get her on her way.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, since I actually haven't made it yet to the committee I'm supposed to be on. We're going to do legal clinics first, since that's first on the agenda here.
The Senate File
969.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I think most members, we do have some handouts, right?
Is Janet? Yes,
oh, they're getting passed off. Okay. I think most members that have been around for a few years are familiar with this whole issue of trafficking. And in the interest of time, I'm not going to give you a whole trafficking 101 lesson, but it certainly has been. We have federal laws we've passed. We've toughened criminal penalties on a state level. We've had task forces to look at the extent of trafficking in the state. What we're here before you, though, is to talk about these very important screening clinics that the legislature actually has funded for 8 years. And they've served a variety of purposes. They're located in low-income and immigrant communities. But the focus now is to really find and identify trafficking victims. And I want to the Senate has, the legislature has funded these clinics in the past, but I believe it's never been base-funded. It's always been with one-time money in the form of a grant. And so they've always had to come back and ask for their funding again. The operating agency is Civil Society, and I have with me Linda Miller, who is the founder and director of Civil Society, to answer any questions that we might have. And I also have Sister Mary Hasbrook, who's going to give you an example of how these clinics really, how they help and assist victims. In the packet, I want to point out two very important information. There's lots of information there. But what Linda has put together, Ms. Miller has put together, is the project work plan and the budget worksheet. And I told her, we never see things like this in the legislature. This is just very impressive that she has, these clinics have won awards, her whole trafficking effort. She's a model nationally in terms of the work that they've done and the clinics that they've, where they found trafficking victims. So I'm just very
proud to have worked with her on this very exciting project over the years. And with that, we're going to have Sister Mary tell you a little bit about finding a trafficking victim.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Sister Mary.
Madam Chair, my senator, and members of the committee. By way of illustration of the enormity of the work that the clinics do, I just want to share this one brief story. A week before Christmas, on a Friday night, I was called by a lawyer from one of the clinics who said, I have this young mother and her son, and we have to find shelter for them now. I didn't really think that it was up to the lawyer to find shelter, but it was. So the next morning I went and was able to arrange housing in one of our convents. I called the lawyer back and she said, good, I will pick up the young woman myself on a Saturday and bring her to her destination. My father will help with the moving. Another piece of work. Then she brought the young woman and her son in. We showed them the room, and I showed them the restroom, the lavatory, and the woman broke down in tears when she saw the shower. My son hasn't had a shower for 3 months. And I realized the emotional stress that also was part of this as the woman continued to cry for the rest of that evening, having found some shelter. And then I had the opportunity of kind of seeing that this person got to the places that had been arranged for her to go by civil society in the clinics. And the first one is to take her to school and rearrange for bus transportation. So this had been done through the clinics. Then she had to show up for fingerprinting. That had been arranged by the clinics, to get food stamps, to make appointments, and to follow through with the appointments with the psychologist.
Mary, could you just talk about what her situation was to begin with? Because we don't really know. You know, was she Russian? Did she
I was just going to throw that in a little later.
Oh, okay. She's keeping us in suspense, and I'm asking
Well,
her.
To really tell you the truth, you know, I'm not privy to her whole story. Mm-hmm. This is where we picked it up. But actually, she had carried these hotline number around for three months. Mm-hmm. And this was funded by the legislature last year. She had found the number at the internet written in Russian. Russian was her first language. And she made the call desperate. And she was able to talk to a Russian interpreter. The interpreter made connections with the police. The police went to her house to give her cover while she got her things and left. And they took her to one shelter, and then she was moved to another and to Minnesota. And that's where we got contact with them. But the point of this, of what I became very, very aware of during this time with this young woman, is that there are so many, many, many areas that have to be covered, and this work is being done through civil society and the clinics. And I just can't speak highly enough about them and that tremendous work that they do. And I just think it's kind of unfortunate that they have to come back and ask for this funding over and over again, because we all know the heavy burden of slavery, that yoke that has to be lifted, and it's an enormous work. And we are so fortunate in Minnesota to have these clinics and this society to do that work.
So, thank you. Madam Chair, the clinics do not just provide legal advice. They also, as Sister Mary mentioned,
can connect the trafficking victims if they have medical needs, if they have educational needs, if they need shelter, vocational counseling, English language classes, whatever it needs beyond just their legal problems to resolve. And I think in this case, this was a woman who came over under an international marriage agreement. And often what will happen with many of these victims is they end up, you know, they were brought here under false pretenses. They thought they were coming to marry someone. They get trafficked into prostitution or just into an abusive relationship. You know, sometimes they bring their children. In this mm-hmm. case, there was a child. They may be not allowed to speak their own language in the home. They may be not allowed to go out, not allowed to get jobs, not allowed to go shopping or anything. So they're kept in virtual slavery. That's kind of one typical or one possible situation. We have many more. We have children who are trafficked, and we have... I mentioned language is an issue, financial resources. Their documents may be held, their passports, so that they can't feel like they can leave. They also may come from a culture where you can't trust the police, that the police are in on it. And so they're very reluctant to go to law enforcement, and that's why the tip line has been very helpful in identifying people. It's a number that other people can call. It's not just a hotline. It's a tip line.
Go back. You said some people believe the police are in on it?
They come from a culture where police cannot be trusted.
Okay.
But they may be involved in being bribed or paid off and to keep a blind eye to trafficking that's going on.
Oh,
not in Minneapolis, Senator Higgins.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
Okay. Okay. That's it.
All right. Any questions from the committee?
Madam Chair.
Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, and to any of the witnesses, it looks like is 100% of your funding now from the state then? Or do you get funding from any place else?
Well, I'll let Ms. Miller talk about that.
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, we have funding from the Department of Justice, United States Department of Justice, that pays for we have subcontracts for the medical treatment, the psychological treatment, five different types of shelters. For sex trafficked women, sex trafficked men, labor trafficked women, labor trafficked men, and families. We have subcontracts for the different types of shelter, the medical, the dental, and we provide the ESL and the vocational counseling with volunteers.
These are asking if you get federal money.
Yeah, so we do.
But it's well spent. So the sheet you submitted says you're asking for $300,000 of state grant funds. What's the total additional funds that you raise and spend beyond that?
Ms. Miller. The total Department of Justice funding for us is over a three-year period, and it is $500,000. We also have other funding for Violence Against Women Act funding for abused people if they do not fall within the trafficking victim, the federal definition for trafficking victim.
Okay. Thank
that,
you.
That gives, makes me have a question. We know that a lot of the Department of Justice funding hasn't been coming through the BURN grants and a lot of other grants. Do you know about your grants for the next couple of years from the DOJ grants?
Madam Chair, this does not come through, my federal funding does not come through the Department of Public Safety Office of Justice Programs. It is discretionary funding rather than the formula funding, which goes through the Department of Public Safety. In other words, we applied for the grant from the Department of Justice, and we got it.
For three years.
Yes. Okay. All right. Thank you. Any other questions? Well, I have to admit, I really am impressed by all of the presentation that you've put together.
And we didn't go through it all.
Yeah, and I'm just astounded at the different countries that people come from.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, all right. Well, thank you. Senator Latz will move that... Senate File 969 be recommended to pass and be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. On that motion, all in favor, please.
please say aye. Aye. Opposed? Adopted. Thank you all very much. Senator Pappas, your next bill? Madam Chair, I have with me a constituent of mine, Susan Armstrong, who is also a teacher in St. Paul at Johnson High School, and she has come up with a very innovative plan, and I have brochures for members of the committee to establish a St. Paul teen court, and I'm going to let her explain the concept and ask for your support.
Okay. Ms. Armstrong, welcome to our committee. Go right
ahead.
Thank
you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I've been teaching in St. Paul schools for 20 years as a social studies teacher and have been very involved in criminal justice issues. And it recently came to my attention that one of the most innovative programs that's sweeping the nation is a teen court, also known as youth court or peer court. And I've done some research. Right now there are over 1,100 teen courts across the nation in 49 different states. Wisconsin has 36, so I feel like we're kind of running behind them. And the way a teen court would operate, or the way that we would like the St. Paul teen court to operate, is this would be exclusively for first-time offenders. These are juveniles accused of nonviolent minor offenses. They would have to plead guilty. They would have to be interested in participating in the program. And there would have to be a referral either from a police liaison officer or an administrator from the building. So if those five criteria are met, the student would appear before a panel of students, somewhere from 5 to 10 students. These would be volunteer high school students who have been trained by the teen court program. The offender would tell their story, answer questions. Their parent would have to be involved. They would answer questions. Any interested parties would be involved, would also be there to answer questions. After the teen panel had was satisfied, they got the whole story and what was going on, they would deliberate, and their job would be then to issue the sentence, the consequences. They would not decide guilt or innocence. They would only provide sentences as they had been trained by the teen court program. With the successful completion of the student-imposed sentence, the youth offender would then not have a juvenile record to begin with. They would also be invited to join the teen court in the future. With the research that I've done in programs throughout Minnesota and Wisconsin, I've talked to students who were on the teen panel. I've read the evaluations from students who were offenders, and students are very, very excited about this program. I've talked to my students about it, and they just can't wait for it to get started. They would love to serve on the panel. They are fascinated by the criminal justice system. But students who have gone through the system appreciate that their peers may understand what they're going through a little better. And, of course, they appreciate the possibility of not having a juvenile record to begin with. And so the advantage to the offenders, the advantage to the peer jurors are significant. The advantage to the community is teen courts have demonstrated a much lower recidivism rate than traditional juvenile justice programs. It also reduces the amount of juveniles going through the justice program, which would certainly be appreciated by the Ramsey County Attorney's Office.
I think that's...
Do you want to stop right there? And
Madam Chair, something that just occurred to me is that for young people, the time it takes from the time you commit a crime to the time you're adjudicated is usually quite long in our system. And young people usually have moved beyond at that point. So I think the idea of being able to have a more expedient process where they can get and deal with the consequences of their behavior in a quicker time could be very valuable, because my experience with young people is that there can be kind of a disconnect. You know, oh, I did that? Well, you know, that was 3 months ago. That was 6 months ago. You know, you need to have, it's just like when we raise our own children, they need more immediate consequences, or they don't make the connections, even as teenagers, between the action that they did and the punishment for their behavior. So,
Senator Rose, thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Armstrong, in your review of the other teen courts throughout the state, how are those funded? Because we do have a teen court in Fairmont.
Oh, you do?
Yes, we do. And so I'm looking at this blank appropriation to the St. Paul schools, and there are some very successful, and it's a great concept. In fact, I'll be honest, my oldest went through teen court for throwing, him and two other boys, throwing a water balloon at a car, and it broke the window. The only problem with the teen court is that all three of them went separate times to the court, and they all got different sentences. That was not good, because the other two were let off. Here I sound like the disgruntled mother, but my son spent a day in the van picking up trash with some people that had more severe crimes, not out of teen court, but that were doing some sentence to serve. So that was interesting to have a son thrown into that situation where, yeah, he broke the window, but perhaps that was not the correct sentence. I am a supporter of teen court, but my question is, if we do appropriate money for this school district, we should be looking at all the other teen courts throughout the state.
Mm-hmm. What I, in my research, there are some teen courts are paid for by the schools. That is the smallest group. Some go through the county attorney's office. Some go through the juvenile justice. And as of yet, my attempts to get funding from those organizations have not been successful.
Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, where are you getting funding from then?
We're not yet. That's what we're trying to get started. And so I'm looking at going through the St. Paul schools, but at this point there isn't funding there, which is why I've come to Senator Pappas and hope
so
that...
So it's totally volunteer right now?
It isn't up and running yet.
Oh, it's not.
We're trying to initiate the program.
Well, Senator Rosen, who funds or sponsors the one in your area?
Madam Chair, I believe it's through the county.
It's probably through the county attorney.
Right,
office.
It's through the county. So,
So Senator Pappas, it is a blank appropriation. What kind of funds are you looking for?
Madam Chair, we're looking for $200,000 for the biennium.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
I would just like to say the son that threw the water balloon is graduating with a 3.9 out of the University of Denver.
Proof that it worked.
Rehabilitation.
It worked.
See, it was that day in the van with those other guys that did it to him.
$200 per year, is that right?
$200 for the biennium.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Right?
Right.
I think that's what I heard.
Right.
Okay, any other questions? If not, Senator Rosen, do you want to move the bill?
Madam Chair, I would not. Okay.
Was that a yes or a no?
Well, I just Madam Chair, I just think it would be.
Senator Moi will.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay.
Yes.
Senator Moi moves that Senate File 1440 be recommended to pass and be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Any other discussion, Senator Neville?
You know, it's terrible to throw water on any idea, but and ultimately you're going to put this bill together as the chair. But with all due respect, you have so many demands, and this is the type of thing that really should be funded by the county attorney's office or the juvenile court or the schools. And I know you're asking for $200,000. I don't know where your target is yet, but... in terms of all the other priorities and things we've heard, I don't want to give you false hope.
Right.
I have trouble supporting that this year. So
it's my intention that if we can get it started and we can prove what a fantastic program it is, that people will be lining up to give us funding.
Well, Madam Chair, in some areas, it probably is a really good idea. You know, just in looking at your materials, I can see some concerns that, I mean, if you take anybody who pleads guilty to a misdemeanor, what if it's an assault type of case?
We would not accept violent offenses at all.
You only take property type things. Now that's a little different, but I mean, I'm one of those firm believers. I agree with Senator Pappas totally that swift sanctions in juvenile court is the best. On the other hand, it's also therapeutic to be facing a county attorney or a judge right in the eye, and it's a little bit less intimidating to appear before a bunch of kids, your peers, for punishment. And frankly, some of these kids should be scared a little bit because of what they've done. So, I mean, it all depends. And in terms of the priorities, I have concerns about supporting it even right now.
Hopefully the screening process where the police liaison and the assistant principals would make the referral. It's our intention that that screening process would hopefully focus on the students that they believe would really benefit from this type of program.
Okay. Senator Foley?
Madam Chair, I look at that, and we use this kind of thing in the North County Attorney's Office and utilize a person in corrections to handle that, essentially diversion type activities. And the only thing wrong with this bill that I can see is that we're asking for state funding to do something that ought to be broader, perhaps. We'd cover the whole state if this is such a good thing. So maybe a pilot project of some kind that would be limited to whatever period of time, and to see whether you can reach the goals you have and whether you can gain funding from other sources after that.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, I know money is tight, so you may not like this suggestion, but there are two things. We actually did have a statute on the books so someone else thought of this idea a while ago, and it funded not just teen courts. It was a grant process that entities could apply for, but it included other types of diversionary activity. Senator Neville, maybe you were involved in creating it. I don't know. So that is one, you know, possibility that we might want to relook at is youth diversion activities in general. Another one is if we want to sincerely do, you know, some kind of pilot, we could pick one urban, one St. Paul, hopefully one suburban, one rural community, and have a broader, we wanted to kind of spread it around the state and have kind of a broader experience in terms of what the possibilities are to do with teen courts.
And then you'd probably want three times as much money, which we don't have. But we will take a vote, and Senator Moy's motion.
I renew my motion, Madam Chair.
All in favor of Senator Moy's motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
It passes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Let's see. We have two bills by Senator Moy and a discussion only from Senator Latz left. Senator Moy, what time was your committee going to start?
7.
Earlier? Okay.
Well, you all tell me.
First?
How are you going to come back to dinner?
We're almost all the same committee anyway.
I have to come back, too.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to take up Senate File 823.
Okay. Mentoring program, background checks, right? Go ahead whenever you're ready.
Madam Chair, we heard this bill in the policy committee. There are hundreds of youth mentoring programs across the United States, but really also all across Minnesota. This bill accomplishes two very important policy goals. It protects children, and it protects the privacy of citizens who choose to act as volunteer mentors for children and youth. Senate File 823 appropriates $320,000 for the biennium to fund as many as 40,000 state criminal background checks for volunteer mentors. These background checks are critical to promote the safety of our children so that they may fully benefit from the strong mentoring programs across the state. The bill also appropriates $10,000 for the biennium to provide training to all mentoring programs accessing these free background checks. The training will include direction on how to handle and use the information they receive, as well as how to protect the privacy of the individuals being checked. I have with me today Ms. Mayana, and I always mess up her last name, Kapinki, who would be willing to answer questions if members have.
You know, Senator Moi, when I was in the health care committee the other day, the child care providers were talking about the background check fees that they get. They're paying between $100 and $150 for their background checks. And I suggested they go see the BCA because they're $8 here. So, Senator Rosa.
Oh, Madam Chair, I guess that was my question is how... the commissioner, the public safety charges for a background check? I mean, don't you just... Isn't
yes,
just
the BCA charges one of two levels, either an $8 one or a $15 background check. And I should have printed out my email because I got the information from Superintendent O'Malley. Is anybody here from the department? Ah, save me, please. Hello.
Hello. My name is Julie Letourneau-Lackner from the BCA, and we do charge $8 for charitable nonprofits or data subjects that are requesting their criminal history or $15 for all other criminal history background checks.
So the child care workers could do the $15 because they were not nonprofits, they're a small business?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay. Senator Berglund, that might... be interesting information for your committee at some point.
Madam Chair, I understand, though, that this $8 background check is for Minnesota information, and I think the child care workers might want to access FBI files and, you know, a higher level of background checks.
That's and I not think that's the $15 here. One, and that includes federal, if I remember reading the email correctly. Ms. Letourneau-Wagner?
Madam Chair, actually the... There is a $29 fee for the FBI
okay, so
in
we
addition.
Got the $29 one. Okay. Yeah, there was, okay, great. Thank you for saving me from not knowing what I was reading.
Thank you.
All right, other questions? I think most of us heard this in policy committee. Any other questions?
Madam Chair, if...
Do we have a fiscal note on this yet?
No, we just...
40,000 times 8. Hey, I guess we do in one fashion or another. Okay.
Right. Madam Chair, if there's no more questions from the members, I'd like to move that Senate File 823 be recommended to pass and be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
You really do that amendment way better than I do. On Senator Moi's motion, all in favor, please say aye. Aye. Opposed? passes 1-0. All right. Senator Moi, your other bill.
Senate File 1549, Madam Chair, I have an author's amendment. Madam Chair, this is a classic case of starting out a bill in one direction, and then if you're smart, you talk to the stakeholders, and you get really, really, really good information that points you in the right direction. And this simple bill came to me from my city. And the reason why we brought up the bill was because in light of our preparations for the Republican National Convention, it came to light that we needed to put in place emergency planning. And my city came and said we need an emergency planner for the city, not just temporarily for the Republican National Convention, but as a city, we need a planner. And in the original bill, we introduced it to go to the Commissioner of Public Safety to create an individual at the Department of Public Safety to work with the City of St. Paul, and in particular in light of the fact that we have a lot of state facilities in the City of St. Paul. However, in speaking with the Department of Public Safety, and I shared with them the reason for why I wanted to do this, it came to my attention that many, many, many of our counties and local cities don't have an emergency planner. which raises some concerns for me. I know for a fact that the Department of Public Safety has worked very hard to put together a team and a broad system of different emergency planners to address, you know, the total state needs. But in my conversations with them, Ms. Idy is here, and I don't want to the information that I don't want to speak for her, but the information she shared with me led me to believe that ideally what we ought to be helping to happen is that I think every county and every city of the first class ought to have their own emergency planner to be working with our very well put together team at the state level so that we can have the appropriate coordination system in place. So instead of asking for this one planner to be at the Department of Public Safety, I'm going to amend this bill to ask for an appropriation for a emergency planner in the city of St. Paul who will be working with the broad network of the different individuals who have been identified at the Department of Public Safety. And this is with in consultation with and I think with the recommendation, although the Department of Public Safety, obviously for you know other reasons, can't be testifying positively on this bill, I've consulted with them, and they think that for efficient uses of resources, it is better that we directly make this a grant to the City of St. Paul for an emergency planner to be in the City of St. Paul. And I would like to also share with the committees that this will be a start. And I think that in the future, we need to look at how we can make this a project to create the same positions for counties and for cities of first class in the state. I have with me today a police officer from the city of St. Paul who would like to speak on the bill. Oh, from the fire department. I apologize.
Senator Moore, let's act on your A1 amendment first.
Senator Moi moves the A1 amendment.
Do we to put have
the
that? Bill.
I just well, got it. I think you should have. I'll give it to you when I get it. On line 8, after the word 4, you would insert a grant to the City of St. Paul to hire, in case you don't have it there. On Senator Moi's amendment, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Adopted. Okay. Now, I think it's Assistant Chief Pleasance. Is that right?
Yes. Okay. Assistant Chief Dave Pleasance, and I'm also Director of Emergency Management for the City of St. Paul. Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members, for hearing this important bill today. Senate File 1549 really brings to light a gap we have right now within the City of St. Paul. In this session, we've heard many committees, including this one, talk about the need to be more prepared for emergencies, including pandemic flu. For example, right now, the City of St. Paul is implementing a citywide plan to respond to a pandemic flu breakout. A major gap in this work is coordination with the state of Minnesota. A pandemic flu epidemic in St. Paul is the same as a pandemic flu epidemic with the state employees. The state of Minnesota has 14,500 employees who work within the boundaries of St. Paul. This does not include the state employees at the University of Minnesota St. Paul campus, or the other state campuses within the city, or either the 10,000 lobbyists. State employees occupy 8.25 million square feet of space in St. Paul. The state of Minnesota is the largest employer in the city. These state assets compose some of the most critical infrastructure within the city. The public safety protection of this infrastructure should involve a commitment from the state to coordinate the unique relationship that St. Paul, as the state capital, has with the state. Yet this city has no organized plan with these facilities for responding to great emergencies. The Senate File 1549 creates such a position to address that planning need. This position is not meant to be a supervisory or a new bureaucrat. Rather, it's meant to employ another emergency response planner whose purpose is to work with the City of St. Paul in coordinating efforts with state facilities. We feel it is the state's responsibility to coordinate with the capital city on responding to emergencies. That's the right thing to do for all of us who come here to work every day. In conclusion, I feel that any disaster in St. Paul is also a disaster for state government.
Thank you, Chief.
Chief Pleasants, do you know how much money the city of St. Paul gets for Homeland Security funds? And don't you have a Homeland Security director? And wouldn't this be an obvious project for that person to be doing?
We have one person that's three-quarters applied to emergency management, Tim Butler, and he's not funded by any Homeland Security grant.
Do you happen to know how much Homeland Security funding you get as a city?
It's various from year to year.
Always.
And right now we're working for the grant cycle for this year. We're pursuing grants in the Urban Area Strategic Initiative, for example. Minnesota Metropolitan Response, EMS-type grants, and we haven't been approved for anything yet at this point.
So you say you don't have any Homeland Security funds?
Oh, yes, this varies from year to year. But
you have a ballpark of how much you got in 2006?
Oh, I would have to get back to you on that, the exact figure.
Not even a ballpark?
Sure, I could... ballpark is probably between 4 or 5 million.
Yeah. All right, Senator Foley.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. When you look at this, there is a state Homeland Security director that probably ought to be involved in this process. I can see where we might want to fund a planner for the purposes of dealing with the Republican National Convention, and I think that the state could bear up under that responsibility, but I'm not sure that we need to look at this in an ongoing sense of the word and deal with an ongoing thing when there already is existing ways to handle it through the federal and the state Homeland Security. The one thing I might say is that a very recent article in Time magazine indicated that the Homeland Security on a national level has not done sufficient to provide any security for here. So I wouldn't recommend that they be involved in it, but I do think that anything we do ought to be limited to a specific period of time, and that situation, I think, is around the use of the Republican National Convention, because that helps us.
Senator
Burwell? Well, Madam Chair, it's my understanding that Homeland Security dollars that come to us are earmarked to be used to purchase equipment.
We're not
authorized. I know there's a boatload that goes for planning and personnel, all kinds of stuff. It isn't just for equipment, unless you got a different kind of grant than.
Madam Chair, we're not authorized to fund full-time employees right now under any Homeland Security grant we have available. It's all equipment, planning, and also exercises.
Yeah. Yes, ma'am. Oh, hang on just a sec. Senator DeBerglin.
Madam Chair and Senator Moi, I just wondered, since there are 4 emergency management staff in Ramsey County, has there been any discussion with Ramsey County and the City of St. Paul about possibly providing a joint effort to provide the security that might be needed for the convention?
Senator Moi.
Madam Chair and Senator Berglin, I think that I wanted to make a clear separation that we're trying to put in the effort for the convention. So the convention is a one-time event. There are federal dollars. The governor and his budget has made a request for, a one-time appropriation for an individual to be working with the City of St. Paul. And so the Republican National Convention, I think, is a separate issue because it's a one-time event. But in planning for that, what's been illuminated is that as a city, as the state's capital city, with all the state facilities that are on within the city's boundaries, we need our own emergency planner. And in conversation with Ms. Idy and the department, it's been brought to my attention that Minneapolis needs its own full-time city planner. I mean, you know, a number of the counties at the local level, they each local units of government, whether it's at the county level or the city government, ought to have a full-time planner, if not more than that, to be working with the Department of Public Safety. And right now, we don't have that. And Ms. Idy is here, and I know that she can't take a position on my bill, but perhaps she could educate us on that need. She also shared with me some information about a federal emergency management performance grant that some of our counties would qualify for with a 50-50 match. Whether we choose to do this for the city of St. Paul or not, I think that the long-term implication is that we ought to give some thought. If our local governments don't have the capacity and there's a gap in that we and there's federal dollars that could be tapped for it, I think we ought to be thinking down that road. So I just wanted to also plant that seed.
Okay. Ms. Idy.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Chris Idy. I'm the Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. And as Senator Moss said, I cannot support the bill because we do support the governor's budget recommendation, but I am here to provide clarification. When Senator Moss and I met yesterday, we talked about the system of emergency management and how, according to Chapter 12, every city and every county is required to have an emergency management director. And actually, Senator Ingebrigtsen happened to be one of those for quite a few years. And we do a survey about every other year of our local emergency management folks, and we ask them about their staffing and their budget, because we do have this emergency management performance grant that is eligible from the federal government that we can match up to 50%. Because it's inadequate to match 50% of the budgets of local emergency management, they've been overmatched by about 70-30. Out of our 87 counties, only 34 are full-time emergency management people. 8 of those are in Hennepin County, and 4 of those are in Ramsey County. So many of the other emergency management directors in the cities of the first class and other cities and in our counties are dual-hatted, sometimes triple-hatted. They're sheriffs. They're sheriff's employees. We have a weed inspector. We have jail administrators. So they can't focus all of their time on emergency management. And if there's a gap in the planning in a city, usually it's because which hat takes precedence at any given time of the emergency management director.
Thank you. Senator Engelbrecht.
Madam Chair, I must ask a question. If there's another event coming into the community, World Series, is St. Paul going to come or Minneapolis going to come to the state for that?
We didn't.
Security type thing? I mean, I'm new to this. I mean, I'm just wondering that. Or would the city or the county take care of their own? My other question is I think Ramsey County has a full-time emergency management director, and I think Senator Berglund alluded to that.
Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, yes, they do. They actually have 4 full-time people. A couple are grant-funded and working on specific projects.
Well, Madam Chair and members, I appreciate the questions, and I think that, outside of St. Paul, the question that we should ask is, the full-time emergency planners are in place. Are they sufficient to fill the gap if there was, an event that were to happen in terms of the planning and in terms of the coordination between the different local government, units of government, whether it's a city or a township or a county, in coordination with our state? And from my perspective, I see that gap in my city, and I'm not asking because of the Republican National Convention was an opportunity to showcase that we need somebody full-time, and that's why I'm here, but that's a separate issue. But I think that from a larger state perspective, I think we need to think about that, because clearly with St. Paul's experience, we've found that there's a gap, and that we need to find a way to fill that gap.
Chief.
Yep. Madam Chair, my purpose to come here today is to point out to you that the state of Minnesota and its legislature and its employees are a community within the city of St. Paul. We are here to protect and plan for you. We're going to continue to do that as much as we possibly can. We're asking that you recognize that that community can come and help itself out and work with us closer by establishing a position of a planner, emergency planner. So, thank you.
And, Chief, that work's not being done in any fashion now?
As far as the coordination?
Yes.
We coordinate with the state just as the state coordinates with any community or county within the state itself. I'm here to point out that there's a special relationship between St. Paul and state government, and that we would like state government to recognize that.
Okay. Senator Brooklyn.
Well, Madam Chair and Chief, it works both ways. The fact that St. Paul has a large number of state government buildings here means that you have a large number of people here who are eating lunch in St. Paul and helping to support your businesses, who in turn are paying property taxes in St. Paul, people like me who end up, you know, plugging parking meters or whatever it is we do when we are over here at meetings outside the Capitol. It works both ways. I mean, whenever there's been a suggestion that one of the state buildings that you have in St. Paul be replaced and be relocated outside of St. Paul, there is a hue and outcry from legislators who represent St. Paul because they recognize the economic benefit.
Except me, because I voted to send the agriculture building out, and people in St. Paul haven't forgiven me for that. Madam Chair, and members, I just want to reiterate that just from my conversation with Ms. Idy, I feel like whether the committee chooses to do this for St. Paul or not, we really ought to give this issue some attention. If not this session, then long term we should take a look at it. And I know I don't have the information here today to do that, and maybe at another time we could invite Ms. Idy and the Department of Public Safety to come back where it's a little bit more appropriate, not in the context of this bill, maybe to brief us more thoroughly on why it is that we do need to make sure that there are full-time emergency planners at the local level to be coordinating with our state agency. I think that that's a conversation worth having.
I think that's right. That would be a conversation worth having. Meanwhile, you have some blank appropriations in your bill.
And, Madam Chair, it is my contemplation that it would be around $100,000 for just one individual. I'm open to however that is. It's the intent is for one full-time person, you know, and we could take recommendations or consultations from the city or the Ms. Idy had suggested, you know, anywhere between. I asked her in general if we were going to fund a position like this, how much would it be given the lay of the land, and she suggested that, you know, somewhere between 80 to 100 would be appropriate. So, Madam Chair, that's what I would put on the table for your consideration.
Okay. All right. Any further discussion? I don't see any. Do you want to move the bill?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move that Senate File 1549, as amended, be recommended to pass and be laid over on the table for possible consideration for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay. On Senator Watt's motion, all in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
It's adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Okay. Senator Latz, you have the last bill of the day.
Thank you.
Do you have copies of this?
Okay.
Must be coming around.
Okay.
Oh.
All righty.
Coming.
There it is. I don't.
We're getting the bill passed out.
Yeah. I've seen that, but there's nothing. Look around. Okay.
Go ahead and start, Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. This is like one of Senator Mua's earlier bills. This is here because of a scheduling issue relating to the snowstorm last week, and we are So we're here for discussion only. It's on Judiciary's agenda this evening, and it had originally been referred to Transportation, and was brought from there on the floor to Judiciary. It's a bill that I'm proposing for your consideration. Senator Neville had introduced this proposal, I think, 2 years ago, and if I remember right, it was passed, but there were fiscal implications at the time that interfered with it. It was passed in the Senate anyway. It moved somewhere along the way. You have an amendment that would substantially narrow this, so let me just give you a quick summary of what this does. People who commit DWIs get their driver's licenses revoked as a result. This legislature, a number of years ago, passed an increase in the reinstatement fee from what had been around $340, actually less than that, about $200-some dollars, up to $680. And it was graduated in, but it's now, when you add the regular fee for getting a new plastic license, it's over $700 to get reinstated for your driving privileges after a DUI revocation. In Minnesota last year, there were about 44,000 DUIs. There were about 29,000 reinstatements. Now, not perfectly controlling for the amount of times that the length of time that people are under revocation, there's a significant gap there, probably 10 to 15,000 cases in which people were revoked for DUIs but did not get their license reinstated. In my experience in private practice and in my conversations with attorneys, prosecutors, and reviewing the statistics, it appears that the reinstatement fee is a significant financial barrier to individuals getting their driving privileges reinstated. It seems to me that it is in the interest of public safety that people get their license reinstated. The other piece of this is that it does not appear that most people who do not get their license reinstatement cease from driving their motor vehicles. On the contrary, most of them, I think, are still driving. The evidence of that is that in Ramsey County, the most prevalent traffic offense is driving after revocation, more than DUIs. I am told that Hennepin County has the same experience. I spoke with a public defender from Washington County earlier today, and he indicated that far and away most of his cases, probably 50% of his cases, are driving after revocation cases. The fact is people who are revoked want to keep their jobs. They still want to get their kids to school or events or whatever they need to do to help out with their family responsibilities. And in fact, if they can't keep their jobs, it becomes even more difficult for them not only to maintain their family responsibilities, such as paying for their house or the apartment and for food, but also it adds a significant emotional strain and personal relationship strain to their lives. If they have alcohol issues, if they are alcoholic or close to it, that can only make it much harder for them to deal with their alcoholism, which in the long run is not beneficial to them, their families, or to the public safety. So the goal of this bill is to reduce a significant barrier to those individuals getting their driving privileges back. The original proposal would have reduced that barrier by creating an installment plan spread out over 4 years. So they would pay one-fourth of the $680 or $170 each year for 4 years, get a one-year license. If they did not make the second installment payment, then their driving privileges would be re-revoked. They could be charged an administrative fee to help cover the costs of an installment plan. Those who have auto insurance quite commonly end up paying an extra, if they want to split the six-month payment into two payments, they got to pay like an extra $7 the first time around to cover the cost of administering that kind of a program. And it was, the original bill was proposed to apply to everyone who had been revoked for a DUI. Let's just say the fiscal note came back very, very high. Because although in the long run, the same amount of money would come into the Department of Public Safety, the transition costs would be quite significant. They estimated that 75% of everyone would take advantage of the installment plan, in effect something like an interest-free loan, or just makes it a lot easier to accomplish. And so you'd have a significant drop in the initial revenues up front. So, and it would also apply to everyone, regardless of their financial ability. And the practical matter is most people probably can, many people anyway, can actually afford the $700 reinstatement, even if they might choose or opt not to pay it all up front if they had that choice. But those who are most impeded by this huge fee are those who are poor, which proxy might be used, those who qualify for the public defender's services. And so the amendment that is proposed for this, and which I will offer as an author's amendment in the Judiciary Committee, would change the plan so that it would be a two-year installment plan. And it would apply only to those who are income qualifying for the services of the public defender. That way it would target those who, for whom the reinstatement fee is the highest financial barrier, and it would also seek to significantly reduce the transitional fiscal impact on the Department of Public Safety and on the programs that are the financial beneficiaries of that greatly increased reinstatement fee. Programs such as the Traumatic Brain Injury Fund, there's a forfeiture reserve fund, a few special revenue funds there that were funded by increasing the reinstatement fees on DWIs a number of years ago. So that's the basic purpose of this bill. I should let you know that the Board of Public Defenders for the state of Minnesota is in support of this. A witness who I anticipate having there tonight is an assistant public defender in the 10th Judicial District. I also have a statement from Sheriff Stanek in Hennepin County in which he says that driving under the influence is a serious offense, should be treated accordingly by law enforcement. That being said, public policy should not make it impossible for people of modest means to get their lives back on track after committing such an offense. The current policy and costs regarding reinstatement fees for a revoked license stemming from a DUI should be looked at and perhaps amended to account for people of modest means. Public policy should not motivate the people to drive without a license or insurance. I applaud Senator Latz and the Senate for their willingness to discuss such a sensitive topic.
Okay.
Senator
Ingebrigtsen has a question.
I just have some questions. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, you talked about public safety. Can you go over that one more time with me, how you think that would...
Senator Latz.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, it seems to me, it appears from the numbers that I've been able to review, that there are a significant number of people out there who could not afford, who got DWIs, could not afford to get their license reinstated, and chose to drive anyway so that they can keep their jobs and whatever. If they are driving without a valid license, that means a couple of things. One is they did not retake the alcohol chapter of the reinstatement process in order to get relicensed, at least some importance in their education about alcohol use and its effect on driving. And secondly, it's quite likely that they are driving also without insurance. This point has been made to me not only in my own experience but in my conversations with other attorneys, including this Washington County public defender. He said usually the DARs come along with a no insurance or no proof of insurance charge as well. And I guess it makes some sense. To get insurance, you often have to prove that you've got valid driving privileges, or the insurance company will check on your driver's driving record. Secondly, it's expensive, and if you don't have valid driving privileges, why maintain insurance anyway? And once you start driving, you might as well just keep driving if you figure you're getting away with it until you get caught. So it seems to me the reinstatement process also requires that the potential licensee submit at least some insurance information to the Department of Public Safety. So that reinstatement process would again ensure that the driver is insured as well as licensed.
No, excuse me, just to follow up, it's not required, though, for a person to have a driver's license to have insurance on their car.
Say that again, please.
I say it's not required to have insurance on an automobile. Maybe I'm wrong there. For them to have a driver's license does not mean that they're automatically going to go out and buy insurance for their car. True. Being stated.
Well, that I agree.
Yeah.
There's no automatic tie-in.
Right. The likelihood you're saying.
People who don't have cars can purchase non-owner operators insurance, which is much more expensive for them. But that is an option.
Senator Engelbretson?
Could I just ask one follow-up? You stated the Defense Attorneys Association was behind it. Where does the Sheriff's, Chiefs, County Attorneys Association, along with MAD, stand with this? Would they be against it in general?
I have not heard specifically from them since this bill was introduced. I would assume if they had a great problem with it, they monitor bill introductions, they would have notified me that they had an objection to it.
Senator Bergman.
Well, Madam Chair, I just have to take this opportunity to reiterate what I said on the floor of the Senate the day we did it. You know, we raised these reinstatement fees in order to pay for a DUI felony bill. And I said at the time it wasn't going to work. A, we never collected the money we thought we would.
Yeah.
And part of the reason we never collected the money we thought we would is exactly what Senator Blatz is talking about. I said people wouldn't be able to afford to get their licenses reinstated.
That's what's happened.
And, and it was an end run. We couldn't really afford to do it. And so somebody said, well, we're going to do it come hell or high water. So they had an amendment on the floor to, jack these license reinstatement fees up and then said, now we can afford the bill. And it was wrong. We did it, and it was wrong. And I don't know, if we're ever going to be able to get out of it again. I know we'll never get out of a DUI felony law. So, that's done. And the irony of it is, the whole deal was I thought, well, maybe the sunny side of that deal was that people would actually maybe finally get treatment because they'd be in prison where we'd give them treatment. Well, then it came along that we had so many people in prison that we weren't even really giving everybody who was supposed to get treatment. So, I feel bad that Senator Blatz has to be here with this bill.
Mm-hmm. Senator Foley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree with what you say, Senator Berglund. I was involved, as many of us were, in the passage of those DUI laws. And if that were the only case and the only thing we were worried about, I wouldn't stop there. But the fact is that you have got fees that were raised in 2003, I think, when we abdicated our duties and moved off the thing in the Senate, at least. And so what you've got is a stop sign violation that is $194. It's shocking. And it goes all the way through. What we need is to look at the whole area of fees and do something about it. And frankly, I think even in local government, you'd be surprised at the kind of fees that you're paying for utilities and out in the street and the water coming in and all of that. My city of Coon Rapids is now raising the fees again. My suggestion here would be to develop a committee to review the fees and make them more appropriate. One of the things that really scares me a lot is the insurance. And I work in a juvenile court, and in that, if they prevent proof of the financial responsibility, we dismiss it. There's nothing. But on the other hand, if you're an adult, why end up going, we all know what happened at Elk River, where the only offense this guy committed was driving without insurance, and they got killed because his cellmate beat him to death.
Senator Foley, somewhere in my desk I have a report, and I think it came off, I'm not sure whose website, Department of Revenue or somebody, laying out all the fees that were collected the last biennium, and I think we got more back in fees than we got in taxes. So I'll see if I can find that and send it over to you. All right, we can't take any action on this bill. Do we have any more questions on it? Not. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll be hearing it again in Senator Mois' committee in an hour or in a half or so. Thank you, members. We've done a lot of work today, and we are adjourned. Thank you.